My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. This next story is of a man who is thriving yet battling with his own mental health. After spending 14 years in the British Army, he left and joined the private sector in Afghanistan. From the lows of a marriage breakup and the death of his best friend, to the highs of fatherhood, fitness, and the Himalayas. Episode 21, Chris Kelly. This is Declassified. You was 5 years old when your mum and dad split up. What can you remember about that time?
I remember, there's one vivid memory of being sat on the stairs in the house listening to them argue. I suppose that's the main memory that sticks out before they split up. And then they separated and I moved, not away, we only moved up the road with my mum and my sister. We moved on to a council estate, rough as backsides, actually as a kid.
Where for the next couple of years,
it's just outside Cleckheaton, a little town in West Yorkshire. Yeah. Actually, growing up as a kid on there for a couple of years was wicked because you get away with anything, can't you? Because it was already hell, so we just walked around and created more hell. But I suppose the other thing I remember is after they split up, my dad, I did keep seeing him, visiting him, whatever. There was one night, late at night, it felt late to me, but it was definitely dark, so it was middle of winter, and he left me to walk up through the estate to go home because he was basically scared of my mum's then boyfriend. So I'm walking floods of tears as a little kid, probably 6 years old at this point.
You scared because of the walk? Or?
Scared because it was dark I was on my own, or I thought I was on my own.
Yeah.
And I go up to the house and I'm banging on the door in floods of tears, and the bloke who then became my stepdad later on opened the door, and my dad had followed me up the road and was peeking out from behind a bush to check I got home all right, which is turbo strange-like, but whatever. And so my stepdad's chased him off down the road. I've gone in, mum sort of consoling me. I remember that. Then maybe a couple of hours later, my dad's rung the house and wanted to speak to me, promising me gifts and all that to make me feel better. And I picked the phone up and threw it at the wall. And that's the last time I spoke to my dad, really, apart from a couple of messages on Facebook a couple of years ago.
And was you five then?
I was probably six at that point, I think. I think it was a couple of months. Remember visiting quite a few times before that occurrence. So I'd probably be 6 year old by that point.
Up until he was six, he was always in your life?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he was following you because he was making sure he was all right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny, isn't it?
Weird how people work, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah. Did you always stay there then, in that house? In the council estate?
Yeah.
That's where you was brought up?
We were there, I don't know the exact number of years, I can't remember, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Oh, okay.
And then we stayed in the same sort of town, village, but my mum and stepdad bought a house and moved down there. And it was wicked, actually. It was a brand new estate that was being built, so the builders had come on during the day and build stuff, and then there was a group of us as... I don't know, maybe heading into our teens at this point, who then proceeded to destroy the place on a night. It must have taken an extra 12 months to build that place.
Yeah, yeah. don't want to incriminate anyone, so that was obviously a fictional... that never really happened. Was schooling all right? Because I know these, especially these northern council estates.
Yeah, I really enjoyed school, for the most part. I went to private school to start with, as a junior, I suppose, that my grandma paid for in Leeds, but I didn't enjoy it because all my mates went to the local comprehensive. So when it got to the senior part, I basically spoke to my mum, said I wanted to go to school with my mates, and ended up going to a school called Wycliffe Mount, which was, I just loved it. But I was big into my sports. As we got sort of later through the years, I became one of the football team's captain, so I got away with a lot as well.
Academically though, doing all right.
Yeah, yeah. Did all my GCSEs and all that, eight. Above C and a couple of B's and all that. So my grades were pretty good. I was, stuff like maths and English, the main core subjects, I found quite easy.
Yeah.
So I suppose I was lucky in that way.
Was it, I'm just going back to my school, and to have anyone that got five A to C was unusual.
Yeah.
Was that
unusual then for you, or was he a lot? Was he a lot of kind of in brackets high achievers in the academic?
I think there's quite a few. There seemed to be some at our school, maybe a handful that really flew. You know, come out with A's everywhere. Then there was, I suppose, a group of us that did all right. I could have done a lot better, to be honest, for a couple of reasons. One, I was bone idle. Because I didn't find it challenging, I think, so I coasted. But then my last year, I was incorrectly diagnosed with lymph node cancer or whatever. I had my lymph gland removed out of my neck. And then on my 16th birthday, my mum was told that it was glandular fever. But I was properly ill. And I pretty much missed my last year at school. I was either in hospital or at home.
The glandular fever made you that ill?
Yeah, there was some other virus, and I couldn't tell you what it was. I don't even think my mum could. It's private health for you, innit? Do you know what I mean? It's cancer? No, it's not.
Yeah.
It was surreal to me, but I was that ill with it that I don't remember a lot of it.
Yeah.
My 16th birthday is when they were told I was in the hospital. They were told it was glandular fever, but I slept through my 16th birthday, but apparently all the family were in the room.
How long had you been in hospital for?
I think I was in and out, but I think maybe it was over a 2 or 3 month period that this was going on, thinking it was cancer. Because I remember the times when I was at home, my mum almost trying to force feed me. Like, you can't give up, you've got to eat, you've got to do this. I remember being fed Guinness because it's full of iron. I hate Guinness now because of it. And I was like, I physically can't swallow, I can't eat.
Yeah.
So my family were of the opinion I was just like, oh, he's been told he's got cancer, he's giving up. And what it was is my throat was that closed that I physically couldn't swallow stuff because my glands had swollen up that much. How they came to the conclusion it was cancer is beyond me. But eventually they found out it wasn't. But there was a good 12-month period afterwards of recovery, putting weight back on because I dropped a disgusting amount of weight. And I was a beanpole anyway at that age.
Yeah.
So I must have looked like a skeleton.
15, 16, yeah, you're growing into yourself anyway, aren't you? And if you lose it all. So you recovered. I mean, you joined the army when you were 17 and a half, is that right?
18. Oh, 18. By the time I went. I went along to the careers office. I think I was late 17.
What did you do then in between kind of exams, GCSEs, and joining up?
One, I grew an attitude problem massively, sort of after being ill. I think my mum always says I grew the opinion that the world owed me a favour.
Yeah.
Couldn't be bothered doing anything. Had a couple of part-time jobs. Binned my A-levels off after 6 months, sixth forms. Too busy going to the pub with my mates and driving around in cars and just acting, as I suppose a lot of kids do. But just never went to sixth form at all. Because obviously they couldn't, at that point, they couldn't force you in the door. So I'm not going.
Yeah.
So my mum ended up kicking me out maybe 2 or 3 times. So I slept rough. And we're only talking first occasion, maybe 2 or 3 nights.
Yeah.
Second occasion, a couple of weeks. Last time was, I think, 3.5, maybe 4 weeks I was out of the house. But I'd been staying at a mate's whose mum and dad had gone on a cruise, I think it was, if I remember rightly. And he'd just passed his driving test and been left his mum's Citroen AX, brand new one. And we managed to prang it into a tree and completely write it off. So obviously the police turned up and I had to give them my name and address and I got delivered home. And this leads to the whole reason I joined the army. It's because I stood on the doorstep with this policeman and my mum basically turned to me and went, why don't you fuck off and join the army and do something with your life? And she didn't mean it. I knew she didn't mean it. There'd never been any inkling for me to join the military. I'm not from a particularly strong military background. I knew she didn't mean it, so I basically stuck 2 fingers up at her and went, fine, I will. And turned around, got on the bus and went to Bradford Careers Office.
So you weren't running away from anything, you've just been stubborn to your mum?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I suppose looking back now, it did end up that I was running away from stuff because without a shadow of a doubt, I was heading down the wrong path. Prison or something would have probably followed eventually.
Yeah.
Completely my own fault. I just had a really bad attitude towards life. Just couldn't be bothered doing anything, so.
Did you have discipline at home then? Was your stepdad still there?
He was still around at this point, yeah. He didn't do the discipline. My mum was very much the disciplinarian. I suppose because she was mum and dad for periods as well. I suppose speaking of role models, it's always been my mum because she's always been that constant in my life.
Yeah.
But my mum was probably at times like what I call an old school mum, I suppose.
Right.
We knew when we'd nosed up and she wasn't afraid to let us know about it.
Mm.
So I did have discipline, but I'm a lot like my mum. So yeah. As I grew older, I grew an attitude and rebelled.
Were you letting her down then when you like smashing cars into trees?
Oh, yeah. At the time, it didn't even register with me.
Oh, right, okay.
Because, again, we were at that point where we were probably falling out, but no doubt it was a huge amount of her being disappointed with me. And because all through school, she was told he's got so much potential, he can do anything but the usual sketch, and I just wouldn't commit to anything. I was like, whatever.
Did you settle in then? You joined Royal Signals?
Joined the Royal Signals, February 98, off to Basingbourne. Again, didn't go to the careers office to join the Signals. I didn't know what I wanted to join. I suppose the only thing I'd heard of, being from a non-military background, was like things like the paras.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I went in and mentioned that, and then did my BARB test, hand over all your school grades, and there was a shortage of technicians at the time in the Royal Signals, so they just went, you can do that, you can get promoted quickly and earn more money. All right then. Off I went, and went to Basingbourne. Not a clue what basic training would be like. That probably helped, I reckon, because I just sucked it up and got on with it.
Yeah.
And did really well, and loved it, to be honest with you. It was everything that I probably needed without realising it.
Yeah. Did you get those... I often say in these episodes, I don't want to put words in people's mouths, but did you then start finding role models within, especially that basic training part?
Yeah, I mean, there's people all the way through something like a military career that stick in your mind. And my troop, full screw at the time, was a bloke called Jimmy Frew, a little angry Scottish bloke, but he was brilliant. We knew, again, I suppose we knew when we weren't performing, because he would come down on us like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
But you could also, I think, turn to him if you needed to. And I think he was quite good at realising when someone probably wasn't feeling great, missing home or whatever. So I suppose he was an early role model during my military career. And then there's been a handful all the way through, different sergeant majors, OCs, whatever it may be, that I've looked up to.
I mean, before we get there, so basic training was done, and where did you go after that?
Blanford, sunny Blanford down in Dorset, to do my trade training.
Yeah.
I think it was about 15 months long. It was quite a long trade training for the tech trade.
What do the Royal Signals do?
Comms. So,
what?
Radio, SATCOMs. There was the old school systems like Ptarmigan. So basically, I suppose a support element, REMFs.
No, I'm not saying that.
And we just roll in and provide comms for whoever was deploying wherever.
Yeah.
And my role within that was as a technician, so I'd be going out repairing broken equipment, maintenance, all that kind
of thing. So everything from a personal radio right up to like the main communications to different countries and satellites, stuff like that?
Yeah, I suppose we'll get to it, but when I was away in Iraq, I ran a satellite detachment, SATCOMs detachment for the Royal Artillery.
Right. So pretty much anything to do with, like you said, the summary was comms, but yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything else? Did they
drink a lot. Party hard, that's the only thing I remember from the Royal Signals.
So that was fair, because you went off to, and then you joined the Royal Engineers after that, but before we get there, so you did 8 years.
About that. So after Blanford, after trade training, my first posting was 1 Div in Germany, and it is still the best 2.5-3 years of my life.
Where was that?
Northern Germany, so Hereford. I suppose in the whole Bielefeld, Sennelager sort of area, and it was just mental.
What was life like then for a young?
Awesome, because I on completing trade training, I found my cornflakes packet and picked a Lanschjack slide out of it, because that was part of the deal with being a tech. So I went to Germany as a 19, maybe 20-year-old. Money, it was still a Deutschmark, so you were getting plenty to the pound, and just went nuts. Just loved every minute of it. The job was great as well, actually. We worked hard at 1Div, but that meant we played harder. Hereford didn't know what I did, hit it half the time. Just a group of young lads and lasses that just loved life.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Yeah. And then, was it always good then? Like them 8 years? Where did you get to? What rank did you get to in
Corporal.
Signals? So you got the Lanschjack really quick.
Got my corporal only a few months after, because I landed in Germany in the September, and I deployed to Bosnia by the December.
Mm.
And there I was acting corporal, came back and pretty much kept it. So I was a corporal after probably only 3 years.
Yeah.
Never got any higher. Just too much mouth. Too much resistance to the system, I guess.
Really? Yeah, you did 14 years. It couldn't be that much resistance.
But when I transferred, I had to drop back down to Lanzhou, to go right. GO. So I suppose there was that element as well.
And so we went... So Bosnia was the first op we went on.
First tour, yeah.
And then you went on Telic 2 as well.
Telic 2, so yeah.
2003. What was it like then? Quiet?
It was relatively quiet. I think to what it became, I think it was sort of the lull after the initial storm, maybe.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that tour, actually. I got to go out and do other things sort of outside my job, getting out on the ground a little bit, which for a young signaller, I suppose, is rare.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a bit of comm support and all the rest. But the main crux of my job was the SATCOM support to the Royal Artillery up in Alzeyev Port. And I just had a team of six, and we set up our SATCOMs detachment, and if it worked, we sunbathed. If it didn't work, I had everyone jumping up and down on top of me to make
it
work.
Where was you kind of based there?
Initially at the Basra Palace, and then when we moved up to support the artillery, it was AZP, Alzeyev Port.
Oh, right, okay, so he was up in the palace and then moved up.
Yeah.
So what was day-to-day? Literally, what was you actually doing then? Just make sure the communications
make sure the
from
comms
Shiber
to... So it was, the SATCOMs basically bounced straight to Corsham back in the UK.
Right.
So we were the artillery's link back into the UK and around. Obviously then we connected them in and around the rest of the bazaars, but we had a main satellite link back to Corsham.
Yeah.
So when it went down, there was a lot of pressure to get that squared away quickly.
Mm. Did you set the foundations up then for I suppose the following Telic?
Yeah, we installed that system there, and we left that system behind for the next team rolling in.
Yeah.
I mean, how long it'll have been there, I don't know, because I never went back, but yeah, I suppose it was. Mm. We put the comms foundations in. I remember spending a lot of time up pokey little mast towers on the port, running cables to other areas of the camp and stuff like that as well.
Yeah.
Putting that infrastructure in.
People forget, you know, the Telic was that 25 days or whatever.
Mm.
Or like the what during the war, and then afterwards there was a bit of peacekeeping and stuff. Yeah. And then there was the rebuild,
yeah.
Or the build started, like the engineers are building camps, and then obviously then there was a lot of infrastructure that had to be built around.
Yeah.
Lads just don't come in, or lads and lasses don't just come in and then pitch up a tent. You know, there's a lot behind a kind of moving army as well, and signals and communications is integral to that. Did you Do you have a family at this time?
Yes. Well, I was with the girl who was going to be my wife, who ended up being my wife. We'd only been together a few months when I deployed to Iraq. Came back and got married. Good old army marriage. You know what I mean? We want to be together type thing. And then had our first daughter 5 months after we got married, early 2004, May 2004.
Yeah.
I suppose that's where the first real hit, probably the downturn came. I was still in the signals at this point, so I was at two SIGs in York when my first daughter was born. She was born really premature, I think like 26, 27 weeks. Weighed 2.2 pounds at birth. Oh. Was still...
Pounds?
Yeah. Was still seated. I could literally fit her
in my hand. 1 kilo, 2.2 pounds.
Yeah. I could literally fit her in my hand. Still slightly see-through. Everything, her lungs hadn't formed, so obviously there was a lot of drama on that. She was born in York. She was immediately transferred to Leeds to the special care baby unit. So I followed the ambulance in the car, but my wife had to stay in York to have bloods and all the rest of it, so all my family stayed in York and her family. I followed Paige's ambulance to York, spoke to the lead consultant there, who basically said it's 50-50 if she makes it, and there's an 80% chance there'll be something wrong with her.
Mm.
It's a horrible word to use, but there'll be there'll be something wrong with her out of this because she's so premature. And I remember being ultra calm, like so calm, like it didn't even register. Got back in the car, drove back to York, explained that to all the family, and then went outside and completely melted for about 2 hours on my own.
Did you?
Yeah.
I thought he was going to say the opposite. I thought he was just going to say there was no emotion.
No, completely melted.
Why?
I think it was once... I think what I found hard was telling everyone else and seeing everyone else get upset, but I couldn't let myself do it in front of people.
Yeah.
I think I instantly, probably semi-consciously, wanted to become that rock. But I remember going out into a smoking area because I was smoking at the time and just... I think I smoked everyone's cigarettes that came in and out at that point and just wanted to be left alone. But after Mae's wife then suffered really badly with postnatal depression. She didn't bond with Paige because she spent the first 2.5-3 months in an incubator.
Mm.
And it just led to so much pressure on a young family. We were falling out all the time. And I think we thought maybe our answer to that was have another child. So we had Charlie a couple of years later. But the marriage, I mean, sadly broke down. It happens, especially, I suppose, around the military environment. We were too young. Looking back, there's no malice. She's an awesome mum to the girls. Can't knock her for it. It's just we didn't work as a couple in the end.
Yeah.
But it put so much pressure on us. It really did. A lot of people know what it's like in the military. You tend to be struggling for money as a young family. All the rest of it. And there was just no release. But luckily, I mean, the good thing is Paige come out of it unscathed. She's 14 now.
Yeah.
Far too old for her age as well. It scares me daily. I'm going to have to unfollow her on Facebook and stuff because it just breaks me in half.
Yeah, the downfalls of social media.
Oh, honestly.
Your dad. you can't take air off it, mate.
No.
She's too big, too old now.
Yeah.
Where are we? So marriage broke down.
Yeah.
When was that? That was
2008, February 2008. I think we actually made the split. And
was
I
you relieved then when the split happened? What was the emotion like there?
Because
you got the kids and they're small.
Yeah, I think initially probably there was a relief because the pressure at home was so intense. I think by that point, I'd almost shut down from it and tried to again my fault. I'd tried to extract myself from it and didn't know how to deal with. Crazy family life, I suppose. Two little kids, a wife that had all the pressure on her of looking after the home and the kids. I suppose I didn't know how to deal with it at that age. So we eventually ended up in a big row, which generally it does, and I walked out the door, went and stayed on camp. She obviously had the couple of months that they give them to find somewhere else, and then eventually she did. She took off. She left the married quarters with the kids. The relationship was really rocky at that point between us. We weren't speaking. So I actually initially didn't know where she'd gone.
Mm.
So I wasn't in touch with the kids. That obviously battered my head massively. So again, I think I did what probably a lot of people do and turned to booze and put the fake smile on and went on basically a 6-month bender, really.
To mask it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you see the kids during that 6 months?
I did further down the line.
Yeah. But she wasn't holding them from you, was she?
No, it's just that she'd gone.
Yeah,
and our relationship was so rough that we weren't speaking when she left.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she wasn't answering calls for a bit, but she was never keeping the kids away from me. It was never that. I think it was that it just hurt. I suppose it hurt her that much as well.
Yeah.
And she was having to start her life again, I suppose. And she had the kids in tow as well.
So when was that, February?
February we split up. So Sheila left maybe around the April.
Right, okay.
And then there was a 5-6 month period up to the back end of the year.
What was that like then? What was that first? Did you see him at Christmas?
Not that first Christmas, but I didn't see anyone at that first Christmas. I basically stayed on camp, lied to my family that I was working, so the usual guard duty and all that. Stayed on camp, and I remember they turned the heating off in the block because all the singlies went home.
Mm.
And I basically lived under my duvet for maybe 10 days, 2 weeks. I remember my Christmas dinner was a pack of crisps and a Mars bar that I got out of the vending machine downstairs. Mm. And I suppose that was looking back and reflecting now, that was the first real point of real depression. And I think just not knowing how to deal with things. So I thought the best thing to do was lock myself away and not have anything to do with the outside world.
Was it painful then, not being with the kids?
Yeah, again... It was, yeah, really, of course it was. It was my first Christmas without them, I suppose. but there was just so much. I think I was still dealing with the marriage breakup as well, and in turn, obviously, in turn, the kids leaving. But yeah, it was just, I think, because I'd spent 5-6 months trying to mask it by throwing booze down my neck and going out every hour I could, I think when I stopped that, that's when it really smacked me between the eyes. And I suppose I thought that life was probably falling around, crashing in around my ears a little
bit.
You
just bury your head in the sand then?
It was a big, it's always been, I suppose, up until the last couple of years, a big wave of comfort for me. You just smash my head in the sand and pretend it's not happening. So definitely, 100%, just, yeah.
I mean, it kind of got a bit worse for you as well then, because after the Christmas and into 2009, I mean, you'll be able to tell me the dates and the times of when it happened, but one of your mates went through something similar. Their marriage broke down. You were all around him originally. He then got posted out.
Yeah.
And then very soon after he got posted out, sadly took his own life. And that really impacted you in a
massively, yeah. Again, like you said, he'd gone through a marriage breakup. He'd come back off, I think, a pretty hard tour of Afghan. Come home, the marriage broke down for whatever reason. He moved into the block, but it really badly affected him. He had kids as well. And us as a group of mates, I don't think you think too deeply into it, but we just rallied around him. Back on the smash again all the time.
Yeah, getting drunk, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's just what he needed to do. And that happened for a couple of months, maybe 3 months. And then in their wisdom, I think the army thought the best idea was to post him away. His wife at the time, I think, was still in the married quarter as well. So they were close. So I think there was constant clashes maybe. So the army posted him away to an RAF camp, and I can't for the life of me remember which one it was. But within, I think, a couple of weeks, he'd taken his own life, hung himself in the showers, and that, it just smacked me square between the eyes. I think it's, and I went through certain stages. I went through not understanding why, then got to the funeral, and I think it's the most upset I've ever been, as in probably tears streaming down my face. Couldn't control myself. And then after that came all the anger, and I did blame the army for posting him. There might have been circumstances around it. I didn't know the full story.
Was it anger then, more than, because why do, in your situation, why does a mate get upset when a mate dies or kills himself?
In that situation for me, it was because I think I thought, and the other lads around him probably thought, that we were doing our bit and we'd get him through it. We weren't thinking that deeply at the time, but looking back, I think we thought we were getting him through it the best way we could. He needed his mates around him in that environment where you grow so close to people through living and working with them, spending pretty much every minute of the day with them. You grow those bonds, and the army cut that bond, and it was bang at the wrong time, in my opinion.
Well, I think it probably was.
Yeah. I mean, again, there might have been circumstances around it that I don't know about. He may have even asked to be posted, but I think if he had have asked, he'd have told us. But for whatever reason, he was sent away. And I was meant to go and see him the weekend before he took his own life. And I was put on guard duty, and I was fuming. I mean, it happens. You get put on guard command or whatever. So I didn't go down and see him. And I suppose there's that little bit of maybe guilt in my head There certainly was at the time, that if I'd gone down that weekend and we'd have gone out and done whatever, you know what I mean, gone on a drink or whatever and had a good weekend, that it might have lifted him and he wouldn't have been that low that he felt the need on the, what I think was the Tuesday, to go in the bathroom and hang himself.
Was there a big drinking culture in then? Because it seems to always revolve back to...
It does always revolve. I suppose for people listening, it must be like, well, were you just constantly off your face on alcohol?
Yeah.
But I think, again, you grow that close, and as young lads and lasses in the corps, in both corps, you live on top of each other, and it tends to be, oh, should we have a few beers tonight?
Yeah.
So it's not like we're going out every night and getting out.
And there's a lot of exercise as well in this, like you as in physical exercise.
Oh yeah, God, yeah. I mean,
so it's almost balanced in a way where you can get away with it. because you're so fit.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
As well, couldn't
do it now. I'd be the size of a house. You know what
exactly,
I mean?
Yeah.
But it was. I think it was that old adage of work hard, play hard, and we did. And I think probably that mentality in the core, maybe both signals and engineers, maybe more than maybe in things like the infantry. It was, I mean, especially the signals. It's the craziest place I've ever been with the biggest lunatics I've ever met. So a lot of it did revolve around drink, but I think that was just what we did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to get hung too much on it, but there is a correlation now between people that have been in and doing that sort of lifestyle. Yep. They break, they leave, and then they carry on doing it. And, you know, you look at yourself, you left 2011.
Yep.
You did 14 years in.
Mm-hmm.
October you left.
Yep.
December the 23rd, you're in Afghanistan doing private security.
Yeah, I landed in Kabul on the British Embassy contract. Really lucky, because my last year of resettlement, I just partied, wanted to go out with a bang.
Yeah.
And then probably with 3 months left, completely panicked that I didn't know what I was going to do when I left. So did a CP course, surveillance course, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then really landed on my feet. A mate of mine that I'd done my CP course with, who was leaving the RAF Reg, bless him, was like, oh, G4S are recruiting for Afghan. Do you fancy it? Went down to London, interviewed, given the job on the spot, handed my passport over, and 6 weeks later, landed in Kabul, like you say, on the 23rd of December, which was just fantastic.
Were you back in, like, speaking to the kids and that, and seeing the kids a lot?
At that point, I was. It's been, and it still is. I think I'm still trying to rebuild a relationship with the kids now, and again through stuff we'll probably cover later on through this passage. I pushed them away because I didn't want to hurt them as well. So I'm still working my way into how I rebuild that relationship with the kids. I'm in touch with them and all the rest of it, but I think the bond's been broken, but I suppose we'll get onto that. So, Afghan, again, felt great when I went. It felt like a new lease of life, I suppose. I'd left the army where my time had come to an end, I think, with the whole situation with Scotty. And I wasn't into it anymore.
Yeah,
I think the army had changed me at that point.
Had you been, because you mentioned depression earlier on as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm jumping about a bit now, but had that been creeping in even when you was in, or was it as in, so 2009 excuse me, your mate killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years later you left.
Yeah,
in that 2 years before leaving, reflecting back,
mm-hmm.
could you see signs of depression?
Absolutely, yeah. I started to become, I suppose, initially a bit more of a recluse, went backwards, started, you know what I mean, staying in the block, not really doing anything for a short period. Then once I signed off, I completely went the other way and was like, I need to make the most of this last year.
Yeah.
And I think I did 3 festivals that year and just put on all the weight because I'd smashed my shoulder playing rugby as well. I mean, that was another issue for me, actually. I enjoyed playing rugby in the army, and then dislocated my shoulder a couple of times and was told no more. I had an operation on it. So the sports side of life had gone as well.
Yeah.
I quite enjoyed being a tracksuit soldier for periods.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Save doing normal work, I guess. I really went low, withdrew back into my room, then signed off and felt that new lease of life. There's something new coming now.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
the excitement of it.
Yeah, but I think it was probably still depression. I just went the other way. It's like, right, back on the booze, let's party.
Mm.
Enjoyed it, loved it, but I think looking back, still the times when I was on my own, I was still really down. Mm.
But it also sounds, and I'm not a psychologist, but it also sounds like it's that busyness as well that keeps it functioning.
Yeah.
And that, you know, right, I'm going for the next thing now.
Yeah.
I'm a year out, I'm going to go for the next thing.
Yeah.
Get these courses done, have a good time, yeah. Boom.
Always
not,
with me.
Not let yourself, the head come out. Yeah. The sand almost.
The worst thing for me, always, even now, is time in my own head. I've always got to be busy with something. And those things have changed over the years as I've grown up. It doesn't tend to be as alcohol-related anymore now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just couldn't do it anymore. The hangovers last for too long.
Yeah, yeah. It's not good as well. It's toxic as well.
Oh, of course. And it's, as everyone knows, it's a depressant, so it wasn't helping me. It was just masking.
What was that, what was Afghan like then? So when you was there,
first,
private stuff, you was there for, what was it, 5 or 6 years?
Just short of 5 years in total. which is a long old stint, and that was in a rotation type environment. So 9 weeks in country, 3 weeks at home. But the first probably 3 years were fantastic. I only did 7-8 months of close protection, and then with my background in comms, the embassy in Afghan had a comms department that ran all the radio networks and electronic countermeasure equipment for Afghan. So, and that's where I met Richie. Big mate, everyone will know Richie. He's 5'6" and angry on Twitter. But because we did the same job in the army, but never came across each other.
Yeah.
So we met out there. So I moved into the comms department.
There was still that. Sorry, mate. There was still that kind of. What do I say? Cliche, but like that brotherhood. There was still like the guys around you, similar backgrounds and all the rest of it.
When I got there, quickly adapted back in, and it was like I hadn't left. Again, looking back, it's like you hadn't left the military. Everyone on the contract was ex-military. They had to be, or ex-police. There was a few ex-coppers on there as well. But 99% of the contract was ex-military. So you did feel like you hadn't left. There was the same bits of discipline. We had to do fitness tests, stuff like that. Mile and a half, press-ups, sit-ups. So you were almost going through the same. Every 6 months you had to do a fitness test. You were going through the same procedures, down the ranges, everything.
Was you carrying weapons as a comms?
Yeah, we still carried both pistol and rifle.
And was it relaxed though? Like that's what because I've never done it. So was it like being in the military, or was it more chilled out?
It was more chilled out. It was more chilled out. Certainly in the first 2 or 3 years, God, I keep going back to it. But at this point, we were allowed to drink on the contract. Obviously, you couldn't have your weapons. You used to have to hand your weapons in, all that, which came out the back of an incident, I think, with Armour Group in Iraq before my time on the circuit. So on a Thursday night, a group of us would go out down the embassy bar, get absolutely wasted a lot of the time, and just have a good time, party with the diplomats, the embassy clients. And we had a really good working relationship with them, probably due to that, because the civil service, bless them, know how to party. Much respect to them. so there was that. But then a drinking ban came in. And again, looking back, probably quite rightly, we were all carrying weapons and there to perform security for these people, not be going out and partying. But at the time, it bothered. It bothered us, obviously, because when that stopped, the fun stopped, because we couldn't go to the bar and interact with these people. So it very much became, I suppose, like at times my military career did, room, office, gym, and not so much the gym most of the time. Used to shy away from it. But yeah, and it was that. So yeah, again, I started spending a lot of time in my own head. And at the same time, a lot of the lads that I was close to moved on to different contracts. Two guys who I was very close with, George and Richie, both left in a short period of time. That's who I worked with. George was my boss. They both left for different things, to take different jobs on. And again, I was spending a lot of time sat in my room. And that's, I suppose, when the next...
Where were you staying? In tents?
We had villas on the compound.
Oh, really?
Oh, like John Lewis furniture, big screen TV.
Okay.
Oh, it wasn't... We weren't roughing it. No. Certainly not down on the embassy compound. In G4S's compound, who I worked for, down the other end of the city, was Corrimex, but it wasn't uncomfortable.
So
it was really comfy. The food was okay.
But you were going back to the room and what, watching box sets or?
PlayStation, watching box sets, or just sat with the TV on. They had like a few channels on there.
How much time was you spending outside?
Normal sort of working hours, so, ish.
Outside though, was you in a building when you was working?
I was in a building most of the time, but we did a lot of moving around, certainly Kabul as well, and going out to provinces doing support for the embassy when they took diplomats around. So I ended up as the comms manager, so running the department. So I was really busy actually with projects and upgrading kit and all the rest of it. So I was in the office probably average 8:30 in the morning till 5:00, something like that. So a normal working day. Bringing around that breakfast beforehand, dinner afterwards. So I was probably sat in my room from maybe 6:30, 7:00 at night through to the next morning. But I didn't do much sleeping because I'd sit and wind myself up. It could be over the stupidest stuff. an argument with my then girlfriend at home, or which would normally be my fault, because again, I didn't realise at the time, but I was just being a bit of an arse because I wasn't feeling great. Obviously,
what can you do? Because you mean you've never been diagnosed with depression, have you?
Never been formally diagnosed with anything.
And you're not going around. I just want to make this clear. You're not going around trying to get sympathy or anything like that. Because I'm trying to debunk that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you was in a real.
Oh, real depression. Rut. And a lot of it, do you know what I mean? I'm not pointing fingers. A lot of it was self-inflicted, because I was still at this point refusing to admit that there was anything wrong, for want of a better word, with me. Again, I was shoving my head in the sand. So there's that reluctance to speak out. And it was initially my family. So one time I was home on leave. My grandma, bless her, rang me. I remember I was driving at the time, and she rang me and almost begged me to come home. She'd been speaking to my mum. My mum had noticed while I was on leave I was going backwards again. I was spending a lot of time, if I was staying at her house, up in the bedroom, not interacting with people, not going out and seeing friends, just spending 3 weeks sat on my backside, probably on my PlayStation or watching telly. But I went back and did, I suppose, just over a year before I actually came home. Because
what was your feeling like then? What was you actually feeling like?
Most of the time, absolutely fine. I think I was coping all right. Like I said, when I was busy, I was okay. But when I came home on leave, I wasn't busy, I suppose.
Yeah.
But
and then in your room,
I wasn't busy. And then so it just, looking back again now, at the time, I don't think I realised it. I was getting worse and worse and worse. What started as maybe a bit of, I'm a bit sick of this, a bit of a sigh, it got to the point which I've written about before, was where I turned my pistol on myself in my room.
What was that? Talk me through that.
So I remember I'd had an argument with my girlfriend that night, which was, it happened more often than not again. I said, it was down to me, who I think was getting frustrated with how I was. So I was taking it out on someone, wrongly, but I was. So I remember it was a good few hours after, I was laying in bed, I couldn't sleep because I wound myself up. I just broke down in tears, and I didn't understand exactly why. So I suppose at the time I put it down to it was an argument and I was a bit cheesed off or whatever. Broke down in tears. I remember going into the bathroom and just looking at myself in the mirror and just, again, I suppose looking back, not recognising the person that I was looking at. Went back into my room from the bathroom and spotted my pistol on the side of the on the bedside table and took it out of its holster or whatever and just pointed it at myself. It was only loaded, it wasn't made ready. I would like to sort of say that. And I had my hand over the top of it, ready to make it ready. And it must have only been a couple of seconds maybe. But I suppose at that point it felt like a lifetime, because it was, again, without sounding, I suppose, cheesy, it was that do or die moment. You either sort your head out or do it. You know, do it, because you're sick of life, you've had enough, and if you're not willing to make those changes yourself and not expect people to change around you, then why bother? And I remember I put it back down, and we had a roof terrace on the villa, and I went upstairs with every cigarette I could muster out of my room, and I sat there for I don't know how long, did a lot of crying, a lot of smoking, and just had that word myself, what that realisation of what the hell have you just nearly done? You know what I mean? You've got people who rely on you, you've got two kids, stuff like that. It all went through my head in probably really jumbled up and really crazy stages. But it was that was the point where I was like, you need to make changes here. And it's solely down to you to make these changes. You've had the warning signs. People around you have tried to tell you that you're not right. Sort yourself out. And the first step for that, for me, was getting away from Afghan. not because there was anything particularly wrong at work. I loved my job out there. I had too much time on my own. So I spent the next year doing courses around project management, because that's the route I'd sort of gone down, ending up as comms manager. Did some project management courses and eventually left in...
Did you feel good because she was leaving?
Yeah, again, it was same as when I pressed the button leaving the army. It was that reset again. Right, you've got something to focus on here, something new to go at. And was concentrating on getting home while doing my job. So again, I was sitting in the office on a night doing online courses rather than being sat in my room.
All right, so it really was busyness then.
Yeah, so again, I was...
Being constructive, like, because the PlayStation wasn't working, the TV wasn't working, but actually being constructive and being adding some value.
Actually having to use my grey matter and do something. And yeah, it adding value and being something for me that would help me progress.
So when you got back then,
did
you, not cured, but was you managing it better? Or was you, was it still bad?
I suppose I managed it initially better because I, it was all new, being back first time properly I'd, since I was 18, that I was, I suppose, living what I'd class as maybe normal life, I guess.
Back up north?
Back up north. No, initially I was down near Peterborough with my then girlfriend. We broke up soon after, so I was working in London initially. So I was training it in and out every day, tube, and I managed to not deck anyone. So I think I was coping all right because I think the tube will test anyone's patience on a rush hour. But it quickly started manifesting itself as anger, real, about stupid stuff though. And not physical anger, I wasn't going around laying people out and stuff like that, but I think frustration, anger, type anger at myself. And I don't know
like
why.
Disproportionate kind of build inside you, like a kettle.
Yeah, absolutely. To the point where I'd sit and be quiet and not say anything, and then it'd be the stupidest thing that pushed me over the edge.
Have you seen that? sounds a daft analogy, but you see that film Mean Machine with Jason Statham? I mean, is it the monk or something?
That's it, yeah.
And he's in his head, he's like ripping people's heads off.
Yeah. And then on the exterior.
He's calm.
Yeah. That's a really good way to put it.
I always call it like the Ace of Spades moment because that's the music that gets played. Yeah, yeah. Like the Ace of Spades moment. Everything's calm on the outside, but inside you just want to rip everyone's head off.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was pretty much all the time. And I'd let really stupid stuff anger me. And then me and my girlfriend, then we split up. And that's when I moved back north and just wanted to go home, I think. Actually go home and be around familiarity, back around Leeds and all that, just northern people, I guess, and go back for the first time since I was 18.
Better people, aren't they?
Yeah, of course they are. that's a lot of people just switched off as well. but yeah, I think just I suppose doing full circle and going back to where I knew.
Yeah.
Again, looking back. But the anger issues didn't disappear. And then it all culminated with, again, a really stupid situation with my current partner. We're in the car, I was going to drop her at the train station and go to work, and someone beeped the horn at me. I'd obviously upset them somehow. And I spun the car around a mini roundabout and chased it, basically started chasing him into town. Quite willing at that point in my head, that Jason Statham moment, I was imagining pulling him through his car window and beating the snot out of him for something that was really stupid. And I looked left, to where Gemma was sat, and she was in floods of tears, and I'd obviously scared her, quite badly scared her. And I suppose that was the next realisation moment that you can't allow this to happen either. You're just constantly trying to screw your own life up for whatever reason. And I got in touch with...
Was it self-destructive then? Is that what you felt?
Yeah, definitely.
But you was functioning well though, weren't you? Because you were still like keeping the job. There was no real alcohol problem. And we've talked about it in there, but you wasn't...
Not at this point, no. There was just... But maybe because I wasn't hitting the alcohol and all the rest of it, I was just, again, when I wasn't in work, I was just sat.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was, again, just sat maybe stewing over things. And I can't remember particular things, what I was stewing over. Yeah. Just time sat
built up.
Just frustration.
Did you go for therapy then? What were you in 2017 now, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you go for therapy?
I got in touch with Save Our Soldier. Because after my first daughter was born, I went through a very brief period of counselling and couldn't handle it because it was raking up my past, all about my dad and stuff like that, and I didn't react well to it. So I didn't want to go through that again. I didn't think... And I'd heard someone recommended Save Our Soldier to me, that they do stuff differently. I think it's CBT type stuff.
Yeah.
So it's more coping mechanisms than raking up your past.
Right.
And different things work for different people. But I thought, I can try this.
Yeah.
So I had a few sessions with Save Our Soldier, and it massively helped.
So the cognitive behaviour training, that kind of stuff. What does that do? What do you actually do?
So basically, when I get to that moment, or well before that moment now, of complete losing the plot about something, I allow myself that moment to step back, and for whatever it may be, breathing techniques or little things that he gave me to do in my head. It's almost, I don't explode now. I can take that deep breath and go, it's not that big an issue. Mm. Just chill out. And it's been huge for me. Strangely, because when I contacted them, I was like, well, I'll give it a go. That type of attitude, yeah. Typical Chris. I'll give it a go. And I couldn't believe the impact it had on me, the positive impact.
Simple things.
Really simple things. And all it's doing is allowing me that split second instead of stepping over the line, stepping back from the line.
I'm assuming you're going to have to keep on top of this, you know, going forward. And there's certain things that you've been doing that have been great. You know, I see you on, like, we've kind of social media met before met in person. And, you know, fitness is a big thing for you. Nature is a big thing. And really, keeping busy, but there's also the keeping busy with being productive, like the charity work that you've done and you're going to start doing. Is that how you cope now then?
Yeah, it keeps me busy. So I go to work like everyone else, 9 to 5, but then I come home and I'm on the laptop or my phone again, doing stuff on the pages we've got on Twitter, the great group, Don't Be Shit, Be Fit, where we just promote. It almost promotes positive mindset through being active.
Yeah.
But we try and keep it positive, and there's a lot of banter flies around, so that's great. And then, obviously, the nature thing is, I just went out for a wander one day. I put a day sack on and went out, because where I live, it's lovely countryside.
Yeah.
I was like, just go for a walk, sun's out. And I was out for hours, and it really, and I was like, do you know what, I miss this.
Yeah.
Because I did my MLT and stuff while I was in the military.
The mountain leader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, I miss this. And it at the same time, Richie set up the Your Skin's Waterproof group on Facebook, and all it is blogging and stuff like that about where we've been, what we do. But and I'd sort of got,
but what, fitness wise or
fitness, anything really, but running is around being in the outdoors, but so walking, hiking, mountaineering, that type of thing. And we started running that, but again, it was keeping me busy. So I'd go out during the day on a weekend maybe for a walk, but then I'd write about it and I'd relate it back to how it helped me mentally. And it does help me mentally. It's almost a reset button for me and stuff like that. And then, so out of that came the Everest Base Camp stuff, which we've recently done. But it's all, if I look at it logically, it's all about being busy with me. Mm. If I'm not busy, I'm an arsehole, because I start moving back inside my own head.
Do you think you're going to have to go for more therapy?
I hope not, but I wouldn't. If I feel myself getting that bad again, I would quite happily go back and speak. Save Our Soldier said, if ever you're feeling it, come back to us. Just because they've sort of signed me off, for want of a better word.
Mm.
Don't think this is the end. If you ever need more support, give us a shout.
Well, you know, you've mentioned different coping mechanisms there, you know, like the fitness and the nature and breathing, just like simple
it
stuff.
It is so simple.
That we can all do. Is this all helping then rebuild the relationship with your children?
That's what I'm aiming to do. That's still very much a work in progress. Because I pushed them away. I didn't push them away. I just lost touch with them working away.
It sounds like there was a defence mechanism as well.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
If you're putting a gun to your head.
Yeah. I didn't want my children to see their dad, or what they probably used to see as their dad, as this broken human being, which I obviously look like to people because people were seeing it.
Do you ever think your own dad's in the same situation as you now?
Potentially.
Thinking that. I'm not here to counsel.
No.
It's just popped in. Actually, the fact that he hasn't contacted you and he's pushed you away, there might be a
potentially. I mean, he's been in touch with my sister. They reconnected. I don't know how that relationship is. When they got back in touch, there was a load of issues around the family, which upset my mum. I will always jump to my mum's defence, because again, she's always been that one constant. And that's where me messaging him came from. And it's the only contact I've had with him in over 30 years. And there was a couple of messages went to and fro. I got a bit angry and told him, basically, if he ever had the nuts to come and face me man to man, which I, at which point I got ignored, probably quite rightly.
I wouldn't, you know, like...
I'd sit here now and say there's that much bad blood internally with me about him that if he turned up and stood in front of me, I'd lose my head and go into him. But I think if it actually happened, I don't know how I'd react.
I'm sorry, and I apologise for throwing that in there, but you know, when you was actually just saying it then about your children, I was thinking, oh, actually, there might be a very...
There could well be.
You know,
there could well be. I think a thing that angers me with my dad and how we grew up is he never even financially supported my mum. He left us, he took off with another woman and left us with nothing and never paid a bean for me and my sister. My mum at the time wasn't working and all the rest of it. So just left us with absolutely nothing. I think that's the big thing for me. Whether, even though I've stepped away from my children a little bit in the past because of how I was, like you say, that defence mechanism, looking back at it, I've always made sure...
Always supported them.
Always supported them. Always made sure the money's gone in the bank.
And we learn from our parents, their mistakes as well as their kind of achievements as well. And let's hope that it all works out with the kids.
It will do. I mean, sure they're good kids. I'm dead proud of them. They're awesome. And hats off to the mum.
Yeah.
She's been fantastic. Like I say, we had our differences, but I could never knock her for how she's brought those two girls up.
Perfect.
I need to stay off their Facebook pages. It breaks me. if they
go on your Facebook page and your Twitter, you're doing some good stuff. Are you collaborating with Jordan?
Yeah.
Jordan Wiley who was episode 9. What's?
So that's in the final throws with Frontline Child, which is he's the sort of ambassador for.
Yeah.
And that's myself, Richie, and JB, all through Your Skin's Waterproof, I suppose, our little group.
Yeah.
Rolling the final throws of becoming ambassadors for Frontline Child, and we're going to concentrate on that charity.
What do they do?
So they support basically kids from war-torn countries and the education side.
Yeah.
So, and it is a big belief of mine, being a dad, that every kid deserves an education. And the only way we're going to change attitudes and beliefs in this world is through education.
Yeah.
And I'm a firm believer that every child should have some kind of education, which is why Frontline Child instantly screamed out before we'd even sort of massively interacted with Jordan on a personal level. I'd seen
what they believed in, you believed in.
Absolutely. Yeah. Having been in the areas we've been in on tours or whatever, when I was in Afghan, you see these kids sat in the street and you just look and you think, what kind of future have you got? And having seen my kids grow up and the basics that they've been given, education, all the rest of it, I think it's an awful situation.
That's good, mate. It's good. And there's a lot of, again, there's a lot of positive to come out of negatives. And not just this Iraq-Afghan generation, but there's a lot of people that are doing some amazing things. And it's when you experience the bad stuff that you can then push on. And if you grow, you can get the good stuff out of it. Chris, thanks so much for coming in today and speaking to us.
More than welcome.
We'll leave it there.